She thought she could now say what she hadn't been able to when she and Bill had been sitting on the bench and eating hot dogs, and it suddenly seemed very important that she should say it. Bill. He looked at her with that little smile, but his eyes were serious. Yeah? Don't hurt me. He considered this, the little smile staying on, his eyes still grave, and then he shook his head. No, I won't. Do you promise? Yeah, I promise. Come on, climb aboard. Have you ever ridden an iron pony before? She shook her head. Well, those little pegs are for your feet. He bent over the back of the bike, rummaged, and came up with a helmet. She observed its red-purple color with absolutely no surprise. Have a brain bucket. She slipped it on over her head, bent forward, looked solemnly at herself in one of the Harley's side mirrors, then burst out laughing. I look like a football player. Prettiest one on the team, too. He took her by the shoulders and turned her around. It buckles under your chin. Here, let me. For a moment, his face was kissing distance from hers, and she felt lightheaded, knowing that if he wanted to kiss her right here on the sunny sidewalk with people going about their leisurely Saturday morning errands, she would let him. Then he stepped back. That strap too tight? She shook her head. Sure, she nodded. Say something, then.
Wrist straps not too tight, she said,
and burst out laughing at his expression. Then he was laughing with her. Are you ready? He asked her again. He was still smiling, but his eyes had returned to their former look of serious consideration, as if he knew that they had embarked on some grave enterprise where any word or movement might have far-reaching consequences. She made a fist, wrapped the top of her helmet, and grinned nervously. I guess I am. Who gets on first, you or me? Me. He swung his leg over the saddle of the Harley. Now you. She swung her leg over carefully and put her hands on his shoulders. Her heart was beating very fast. No, he said, around my waist, okay? I have to keep my arms and hands free to run the controls. She slipped her hands in between his arms and sides and clasped them in front of his flat stomach. All at once, she felt as if she were dreaming again. Had all of this come out of one small drop of blood on a sheet? An impulse decision to walk out of her front door and just keep going? Was that even possible? Dear God, please let this not be a dream, she thought. Feet up on the pegs, check. She put them there and was fearfully enchanted when Bill rocked the bike upright and booted back the kickstand. Now, with only his feet holding them steady, it felt to her like the moment when a small boat's last mooring is slipped, and it floats beside the dock, nodding more freely on the waves than previously. She leaned a little closer to his back, closed her eyes, and inhaled deeply. The smell of sun-warmed leather was pretty much as she had imagined it would be, and that was good. It was all good, scary, and good. I hope you like this, Bill said. I really do. He pushed a button on the right handlebar, and the Harley went off like a gun beneath them. Rosie jumped and slipped closer to him, her grip tightening and becoming a little less self-conscious. Everything okay? He called. She nodded, realized he couldn't see that, and shouted back that yes, everything was fine. A moment later, the curb to their left was rolling backward. He snatched a quick glance over her shoulder for traffic, then swung across Trenton Street to the right side. It wasn't like a turn in a car. The motorcycle banked, like a small airplane lining itself up with a runway. Bill twisted the throttle and the Harley scooted forward, blowing a rattle of wind into her helmet and making her laugh. I thought you'd like it, Bill called back over his shoulder as they stopped at the traffic light on the corner. When he put his foot down, it was as if they were tethered to solid land once more, but by the thinnest of lines. When the light turned green, the engine roared under her again, with more authority this time, and they swung into Deering Avenue, running beside Bryant Park, rolling through the shadows of old oaks that were printed on the pavement like inkblots. She looked up over his right shoulder and saw the sun leading them through the trees, flashing in her eyes like a heliograph. And when he leaned the bike onto Calumet Avenue, she leaned with him. I thought you'd like it, he'd said as they started off. But she only liked it while they were crossing the north side of the city, hopscotching through increasingly suburban neighborhoods, where the hip-to-hip frame houses made her think of All in the Family, and there seemed to be a wee nip on every corner. By the time they were on the skyway out of the city, she was not just liking it, but loving it. And when he left the skyway for Route 27, two-lane blacktop which traced the edge of the lake all the way up into the next state, she felt she would have been happy to go on forever. If he'd asked her what she thought about going all the way to Canada, maybe catch a Blue Jays game in Toronto, she would simply have laid her helmeted head against the leather between his shoulder blades so he could feel her nod. Highway 27 was the best. Later in the summer, it would be heavy with traffic, even at this hour of the morning. But today, it was almost empty, a black ribbon with a yellow stitch running down the middle. On their right, the lake winked a fabulous blue through the running trees. On their left, they passed dairy farms, tourist cabins, and souvenir shops just opening for the summer. She felt no need to talk, was not sure she could have talked, even if called upon to do so. He gradually twisted the Harley's throttle until the red speedometer needle stood straight up from its pin like a clock hand indicating noon, and the wind rattled harder in her helmet. To Rosie, it was like the dreams of flying she'd had as a young girl, dreams in which she'd gone racing with fearless exuberance over fields and rock walls and rooftops and chimneys, with her hair rippling like a flag behind her. She had awakened from those dreams, shaking, sweat-drenched, both terrified and delighted, and she felt that way now. When she looked to her left, she saw her shadow flowing along beside her as it had in those dreams, but now there was another shadow with it, and that made it better. If she had ever in her whole life felt as happy as she did at that moment, she didn't know when it had been. The whole world seemed perfect around her, and she perfect within it. There were delicate fluctuations of temperature, cold as they flew through wide swales of shadow or descended into dips, warm when they passed into the sun again. At 60 miles an hour, the smells came in capsules so concentrated, it was as if they were being fired out of ramjets. Cows, manure, hay, earth, cut grass, fresh tar as they blipped by a driveway repaving project, oily blue exhaust as they came up behind a laboring farm truck. A mongrel dog lay in the back of the truck with its muzzle on its paws, looking at them without interest. When Bill swung out to pass on a straight stretch, the farmer behind the wheel raised a hand to Rosie. She could see the crow's feet around his eyes, the reddened, chapped skin on the side of his nose, the glint of his wedding ring in the sunshine. Carefully, like a tightrope walker doing a stunt without a net, she slid one hand out from under Bill's arm and waved back. The farmer smiled at her, then slipped behind them. 10 or 15 miles out of the city, Bill pointed ahead at a gleaming metal shape in the sky. A moment later, she could hear the steady beat of the helicopter's rotors, and a moment after that, she could see two men seated in the Perspex bubble. As the chopper flashed over them in a clattery rush, she could see the passenger leaning over to shout something in the pilot's ear. "I can see everything," she thought, and then wondered why that should seem so amazing. She really wasn't seeing anything she couldn't see from a car, after all, except I am, she thought. I am because I'm not looking at it through a window, and that makes it stop being just scenery. It's the world, not scenery, and I'm in it. I'm flying across the world, just like in the dreams I used to have, but now I'm not doing it alone. The motor throbbed steadily between her legs. It wasn't a sexy feeling exactly, but it made her very aware of what was down there and what it was for. When she wasn't looking at the passing countryside, she found herself looking with fascination at the small dark hairs on the nape of Bill's neck and wondering how it would feel to touch them with her fingers, to smooth them down like feathers. An hour after leaving the skyway, they were in deep country. Bill walked the Harley deliberately down through the gears to second, and when they came to a sign reading Shoreland Picnic Area, Camping by Permit Only, he dropped to first and turned onto a gravel lane. "Hang on," he said. She could hear him clearly now that the wind was no longer blowing a hurricane through her helmet. "Bumps." There were bumps, but the Harley rode them easily, turning them into mere swells. 5 minutes later, they pulled into a small dirt parking area. Beyond it were picnic tables and stone barbecue pits spotted on a wide, shady expanse of green grass, which dropped gradually down to a rocky shingle which could not quite be termed a beach. Small waves came in, running up the shingle in polite, orderly procession. Beyond them, the lake opened out all the way to the horizon, where any line marking the point where the sky and the water met was lost in a blue haze. Shoreland was entirely deserted except for them, and when Bill switched the Harley off, the silence took her breath away. Over the water, gulls turned and turned, crying toward the shore in their high-pitched, frantic voices. Somewhere far to the west, there was the sound of a motor, so dim it was impossible to tell if it was a truck or a tractor. That was all. He scraped a flat rock toward the side of the bike with the toe of his boot, then dropped the kickstand so the foot would rest on the rock. He got off and turned toward her, smiling. When he saw her face, the smile turned to an expression of concern. "Rosie, are you all right?" She looked at him, surprised. "Yes, why?" "You've got the funniest look." "I'll bet," she thought. "I'll just bet." "I'm fine," she said. "I feel a little bit like all of this is a dream, that's all. I keep wondering how I got here." She laughed nervously.
"But you're not going to faint or anything?" Rosie laughed more naturally this time.
"No, I'm fine, really."
"And you liked it?"
"Loved it."
She was fumbling at the place where the strap wove through the helmet's locking rings, but without much success. "Those are hard the first time. Let me help you." He leaned close to slip the strap free, kissing distance again, only this time he didn't draw away. He used the palms of his hands to lift the helmet off her head, and then kissed her mouth. Letting the helmet dangle by its straps from the first two fingers of his left hand, while he put his right against the small of her back. And for Rosie, the kiss made everything all right. The feel of his mouth and the pressure of his palm was like coming home. She felt herself starting to cry a little, but that was all right. These tears didn't hurt. He pulled back from her a little, his hand still on the small of her back, the helmet still bumping softly against her knee in little pendulum strokes, and looked into her face. "All right." "Yes," she tried to say, but her voice had deserted her. She nodded instead. "Great," he said, and then, gravely, like a man doing a job, he kissed her cool, wet cheeks high up and in toward her nose, first under her right eye and then under her left. His kisses were as soft as fluttering eyelashes. She had never felt anything like them, and she suddenly put her arms around his neck and hugged him fiercely, with her face against the shoulder of his jacket and her eyes, still trickling tears, shut tight. He held her, the hand which had been pressed against her back now stroking the plait of her hair. After a while she pulled back from him and rubbed her arm across her eyes and tried to smile. "I don't always cry," she said. "You probably don't believe that, but it's true." "I believe it," he said, and took off his own helmet. "Come on and give me a hand with this cooler." She helped him unsnap the elastic cords which held it, and they carried it down to one of the picnic tables. Then she stood looking down at the water.
"This must be the most beautiful place in the world," she said. "I can't believe there's nobody here but us."
"Well, Highway 27's a little off the regular tourist track. I first came here with my folks when I was just a little kid. My dad said he found it almost by accident, rambling on his bike. Even in August, there aren't many people here, when the rest of the lakeside picnic areas are jammed." She gave him a quick glance.
"Have you brought other women here?"
"Nope," he said. "Would you like to take a walk? We could work up an appetite for lunch, and there's something I could show you."
"What?"
"It might be better just to show you," he said.
"All right."
He led her down by the water, where they sat side by side on a big rock and took off their footgear. She was amused by the fluffy white athletic socks he had on under the motorcycle boots. They were the kind she associated with junior high school.
"Leave them or take them?"
she asked, holding up her sneakers. He thought about it. "You take yours, I'll leave mine. Damn boots are almost impossible to put back on even when your feet are dry. If they're wet, you can forget it." He stripped off the white socks and laid them neatly across the blocky toes of the boots. Something in the way he did it and the prim way they looked made her smile.
"What?"
She shook her head. "Nothing. Come on, show me your surprise. They walked north along the shore, Rosie with her sneakers in her left hand, Bill leading the way. The first touch of the water was so cold it made her gasp, but after a minute or two it felt good. She could see her feet down there like pale, shimmering fish, slightly separated from the rest of her body at the ankles by refraction. The bottom felt pebbly, but not actually painful. You could be cutting them to pieces and not know, she thought. You're numb, sweetheart. But she wasn't cutting them. She felt he would not let her cut them. The idea was ridiculous, but powerful. About 40 yards along the shore, they came to an overgrown path winding up the embankment, grainy white sand amid low, tough juniper bushes, and she felt a small shiver of déjà vu, as if she had seen this path in a barely remembered dream. He pointed to the top of the rise and spoke in a low voice, "We're going up there. Be as quiet as you can." He waited for her to slip into her sneakers and then led the way. He stopped and waited for her at the top, and when she joined him and started to speak, he first put a finger on her lips and then pointed with it. They were at the edge of a small brushy clearing, a kind of overlook 50 feet or so above the lake. In the center was a fallen tree. Beneath the tangle of the soil-encrusted roots lay a trim red fox, giving suck to 3 kits. Nearby, a fourth was busily chasing his own tail in a patch of sunlight. Rosie stared at them, entranced. He leaned close to her, his whisper tickling her ear and making her feel shivery. "I came down day before yesterday to see if the picnic area was still here and still nice. I hadn't been here in 5 years, so I couldn't be sure. I was walking around and found these guys. Vulpes fulva, the red fox. The little ones are maybe 6 weeks old. How do you know so much about them?" Bill shrugged. "I like animals, that's all," he said. "I read about them and try to see them in the wild when I can. Do you hunt?" "God, no. I don't even take pictures. I just look." The vixen had seen them now. Without moving, she grew even more still within her skin, her eyes bright and watchful. "Don't you look straight at her?" Rosie thought suddenly. She had no idea of what this thought meant. She only knew it wasn't her voice she was hearing in her head. "Don't you look straight at her. That's not for the likes of you."
"They're beautiful," Rosie breathed.
She reached out for his hand and enfolded it in both of hers.
"Yes, they are," he said.
The vixen turned her head to the fourth kit, who had given up on his tail and was now pouncing at his own shadow. She uttered a single high-pitched bark. The kit turned, looked impudently at the newcomers standing at the head of the path, then trotted to his mother and lay down beside her. She licked the side of his head, grooming him quickly and competently, but her eyes never left Rosie and Bill.
"Does she have a mate?"
Rosie whispered.
"Yeah, I saw him before. A good-sized dog."
"Is that what they're called?"
"Uh-huh, dogs."
"Where is he?"
"Somewhere around, hunting. The little ones probably see a lot of gulls with broken wings dragged home for dinner."
Rosie's eyes drifted to the roots of the tree beneath which the foxes had made their den, and she felt déjà vu touch her again. A brief image of a root moving as if to clutch came to her, shimmered, then slipped away.
"Are we scaring her?"
Rosie asked. "Maybe a little. If we tried to get closer, she'd fight."
"Yes," Rosie said.
"And if we messed with them, she'd repay."
He looked at her oddly.
"Well, I guess she'd try, yeah."
"I'm glad you brought me to see them."
His smile lit his whole face.
"Good.
Let's go back. I don't want to scare her. And I'm hungry."
"All right, I am too."
He raised one hand and waved solemnly. The vixen watched with her bright, still eyes, and then wrinkled back her snout in a soundless growl, showing a row of neat white teeth.
"Yeah," he said, "you're a good mama. Take care of them."
He turned away. Rosie started to follow, then looked back once into those bright, still eyes. The vixen's snout was still rolled back, exposing her teeth as she suckled her kits in the silent sunshine. Her fur was orange rather than red, but something about that shade, its violent contrast to the lazy green around it, made Rosie shiver again. A gull swooped overhead, printing its shadow across the brushy clearing,
But the vixen's eyes never left Rosie's face. She felt them on her, watchful and deeply concentrated in their stillness, even when she turned to follow Bill. "Will they be all right?" she asked when they reached the waterside again. She held his shoulder, balancing as she removed first her left sneaker and then her right. "You mean, will the kits be hunted down?" Rosie nodded. "Not if they stay out of gardens and hen houses, and Mom and Pop'll be wise enough to keep them away from farms, if they keep normal, that is. The vixen's 4 years old, at least. The dog, maybe 7. I wish you'd seen him. He's got a brush the color of leaves in October." They were halfway back to the picnic area, ankle deep in the water. She could see his boots up ahead on the rock where he'd left them, with the prim white socks lying across the square toes. "What do you mean, if they keep normal?" "Rabies," he said. "More often than not, it's rabies that leads them to the gardens and hen houses in the first place. Gets them noticed, gets them killed. The vixens get it more often than the dogs, and they teach the kits dangerous behavior. Knocks the dogs down quick, but a vixen can carry rabies a long time, and they keep getting worse." "Do they?" she asked. "What a shame." He stopped, looked at her pale, thoughtful face, then gathered her into his arms and hugged her. "It doesn't have to happen," he said. "They've got along fine so far."
"But it could happen. It could."
He considered this and nodded. "Sure, yeah," he said at last. "Anything could. Come on, let's eat. What do you say?"
"I say that sounds like a good idea."
But she thought she wouldn't eat much, that she'd been haunted out of her appetite by the vixen's bright regard. When he began laying out the food, however, she was instantly ravenous. Breakfast had been orange juice and a single slice of dry toast. She'd been as excited and fearful as a bride on the morning of her wedding. Now, at the sight of bread and meat, she forgot all about the fox's earth north of the beach. He kept taking food out of the cooler. Cold beef sandwiches, tuna sandwiches, chicken salad, potato salad, coleslaw, 2 cans of Coke, a thermos of what he said was iced tea, 2 pieces of pie, a large slab of cake, until it made her think of clowns piling out of the little car at the circus, and she laughed. It probably wasn't polite, but she had enough confidence in him now not to feel she had to be merely polite. That was good, because she wasn't sure she could have helped herself anyway. He looked up, holding a salt shaker in his left hand and a pepper shaker in his right. She saw he had carefully put scotch tape over the holes in case they fell over, and that made her laugh harder than ever. She sat down on the bench running down one side of the picnic table and put her hands over her face and tried to get a grip. She'd almost made it when she peeked through her fingers and saw that amazing stack of sandwiches. 6 for 2 people, each cut on the diagonal and neatly sealed in a baggie. That set her off again. "What?" he asked, smiling himself. "What, Rosie?"
"Were you expecting friends to drop by?" she asked, still giggling. "A Little League team, maybe, or a Boy Scout troop?"
His smile widened, but his eyes continued to hold that serious look. It was a complicated expression, one that said he understood both what was funny here and what was not. And in it, she finally saw that he really was her own age, or close enough not to matter. "I wanted to make sure you'd have something that you liked, that's all." Her giggles were tapering off, but she continued to smile at him. What struck her most was not his sweetness, which made him seem younger, but his openness, which now made him seem somehow older. "Bill, I can eat just about anything," she said.
"I'm sure you can," he said, sitting down beside her. "But that's not what this is about. I don't care so much about what you can stand or what you can manage as I do about what you like and want to have. Those are the kinds of things I want to give you, because I'm crazy about you."
She looked at him solemnly, the laughter gone, and when he took her hand, she covered it with her other one. She was trying to get what he just said straight in her mind and finding it hard going. It was like trying to get a bulky, bulky piece of furniture through a narrow doorway, turning it this way and that, trying to find an angle where everything would finally work.
"Why?" she asked. "Why me?"
He shook his head. "I don't know. Fact is, Rosie, I don't know very much about women."
I had a girlfriend when I was a junior in high school, and we probably would have slept together eventually, but she moved away before it could happen. I had a girlfriend when I was a freshman in college, and I did sleep with her. Then 5 years ago, I got engaged to a wonderful girl I met in the city zoo, of all places. Her name was Bronwyn O'Hara. Sounds like something out of Margaret Mitchell, doesn't it? It's a lovely name. She was a lovely girl. She died of a brain aneurysm.
Oh, Bill, I'm so sorry.
Since then, I've dated a couple of girls, and I'm not exaggerating. I've dated a couple of girls, period. End of story. My parents fight over me. My father says I'm dying on the vine. My mother says, leave the boy alone. Stop scolding. Only she says it's scolding. Rosie smiled. Then you walked into the shop and found that picture. You knew you had to have it from the word go, didn't you?
Yes.
That's how I felt about you. I just wanted you to know that. Nothing that's happening here is happening out of kindness or charity or duty. None of what's happening here is happening because poor Rosie has had such a hard, hard life. He hesitated and then said, it's happening because I'm in love with you.
You can't know that. Not yet.
I know what I know, he said, and she found the gentle insistence in his tone a little frightening. Now, that's enough soap opera. Let's eat. They did. When they were done and Rosie's stomach felt stretched drumhead tight against the waistband of her pants, they repacked the cooler and Bill strapped it onto the Harley's carrier again. No one had come. Shoreland was still all theirs. They went back down to the waterside and sat on the big rock again. Rosie was starting to feel very strongly about this rock. It was, she thought, the kind of rock you could come to visit once or twice a year, just to say thanks. If things turned out well, that was. And she thought they were, at least so far. She could not, in fact, think of a day that had been better. Bill put his arms around her, then placed the fingers of his left hand on her right cheek, turning her face toward him. He began kissing her. 5 minutes later, she did feel close to fainting, half in a dream and half out, excited in a way she had never conceived of, excited in a way that made sense of all the books and stories and movies she hadn't really understood before, but had taken on faith, the way a blind person will take on faith a sighted person's statement that a sunset is beautiful. Her cheeks were burning. Her breasts felt flushed and tender from his gentle touch through her blouse, and she found herself wishing that she hadn't worn a bra. The thought made her cheeks flush brighter than ever. Her heart was racing, but that was good. It was all good. Over the line and into wonderful, in fact. She put her hand on him down there, felt how hard he was. It was like touching stone, except stone would not have throbbed beneath her palm like her own heart. He left her hand where it was for a minute, then raised it gently and kissed the palm.
No more now, he said. Why not?
She looked at him candidly, without artifice. Norman was the only man she had known sexually in her entire life, and he was not the sort of man who got hot simply because you touched him there through his pants. Sometimes, increasingly in the last few years, he didn't get hot at all. Because I won't be able to stop without suffering a most severe case of blue balls. She looked at him with such frowning, earnest puzzlement that he burst out laughing. Never mind, Rosie. It's just that I want everything to be right the first time we make love. No mosquitoes biting our butts, no rolling in the poison oak, no kids from UC showing up at a vital moment. Besides, I promised to have you back by 4 so you could sell T-shirts, and I don't want you to have to race the clock. She looked down at her watch and was startled to see it was 2:10. If they had been sitting on the rock and making out for only 5 or 10 minutes, how was that possible? She came to the reluctant but rather marvelous conclusion that it wasn't. They had been here for 30 minutes at least, maybe closer to 45 minutes. Come on, he said, sliding off the rock. He grimaced as the soles of his feet splashed into the cold water, and she caught just a glimpse of the bulge in his pants before he turned away. I did that, she thought, and was astonished at the feelings which came with the thought—pleasure, amusement, even a slight smugness. She slipped off the rock next to him and was holding his hand in hers before she realized she had taken it. Okay, what now?
How about a little walk before we start back? Cool off.
All right, but let's stay away from the foxes. I don't want to disturb them again.
Her, she thought. I don't want to disturb her again.
All right, we'll walk south.
He started to turn away. She squeezed his hand to make him turn back again, and when he did, Rosie stepped into his arms and slipped her own arms around his neck. The hardness below his waist wasn't gone entirely, not yet, and she was glad. She'd had no idea until today that there was something in that hardness a woman could really like. She'd honestly thought it a fiction of those magazines whose main job it was to sell clothes and makeup and hair products. Now she knew a little more, perhaps. She pressed herself firmly against that hard place and looked into his eyes.
Do you mind if I say something my mother taught me to say when I went to my first birthday party? I was 4 or 5, I think.
Go ahead, he said, smiling.
Thank you for a lovely time, Bill. Thank you for the most lovely day I've had since I grew up. Thank you for asking me.
Bill kissed her.
It's been nice for me too, Rosie. It's been years since I felt this happy. Come on, let's walk.
They went south along the shore this time, walking hand in hand. He led her up another path and into a long, narrow hayfield that looked as if it hadn't been touched in years. The afternoon light lay across it in dusty beams, and butterflies skittered through the timothy grass, weaving aimless courses. Bees droned, and off to their left, a woodpecker tack-hammered a tree relentlessly. He showed her flowers, naming most of them. She thought he got a couple wrong, but didn't tell him. Rosie pointed out a cluster of fungi around the base of an oak at the edge of the field and told him they were toadstools, but not too dangerous because they were bitter. It was the ones that didn't taste bitter that could get you in trouble or get you killed. By the time they got back to the picnic area, the college kids Bill had spoken of had arrived, a van and a four-wheel drive scout full of them. They were amiable but noisy as they went about carrying coolers filled with beer into the shade and then setting up their volleyball net. A boy of about 19 was carrying his girlfriend, clad in khaki shorts and a bikini top, around on his shoulders. When he broke into a trot, she began to scream happily and beat the top of his crew-cut head with the palms of her hands. As she watched them, Rosie found herself wondering if the girl's screams carried to the vixen in her clearing, and supposed they did. She could almost see her lying there with her brush curled over her sleeping milk-stuffed kits, listening to the human screams from down the beach, her ears cocked, her eyes bright and crafty, and all too capable of madness. It knocks the dogs down quick, but a vixen can carry it a long time, Rosie thought, and then recalled the toadstool she'd spotted on the edge of the overgrown meadow, growing in the shadows where it was damp. Spider toadstools, her grandmother had called them when she pointed them out to Rosie one summer. And while that was a name that must have been special to Grandma Weeks, certainly it was not one Rosie had ever seen since in any book of plants, she had never forgotten the somehow nasty look of them, the pale and waxy flesh swarming with dark spots that did look a little like spiders, she supposed, if your imagination was good, and hers had been. A vixen can carry rabies a long time, she thought again. It knocks the dogs down quick, but... Rosie, are you cold? She looked at him, not understanding. You were shivering.
No, I'm not cold.
She looked at the kids, who did not see her and Bill because they were past the age of 25, and then back to him.
But maybe it's time to go back.
He nodded.
I think you're right.
The traffic was heavier on the return trip, and heavier still once they left the Skyway. It slowed them down, but never quite stopped them. Bill darted the big Harley through holes when they appeared, making Rosie feel a little as if she were riding on the back of a trained dragonfly. But he took no unreasonable chances, and she never doubted him. Even when he took them up the dotted line between lanes, passing big semis on either side, lined up like patient mastodons as they waited for their turn to go through the Skyway toll booths. By the time they began passing signs which read Waterfront and Aquarium and Ettinger's Pier and Amusement Park,
Rosie was glad they had left when they had. She was going to be on time for her shift in the T-shirt booth, and that was good. She was going to introduce Bill to her friends, and that was even better. She was sure they were going to like him. As they passed beneath a bright pink banner reading, "Swing into Summer with Daughters and Sisters," Rosie felt a burst of happiness, which she would remember later on that long, long day, with sickened horror. She could see the roller coaster now, all curves and complicated strut work silhouetted against the sky, could hear the screams drifting off it like vapor. She hugged Bill tighter for a moment and laughed. Everything was going to be all right, she thought. And when she remembered, for just a moment, the vixen's dark and watchful eye, she pushed the memory away, as one will push away a memory of death at a wedding.
While Bill Steiner was negotiating his motorcycle carefully up the lane leading to Shoreland, Norman Daniels was negotiating his stolen car into a huge parking lot on Press Street. This lot was about 5 blocks from Ettinger's Pier and served half a dozen lakeside attractions: the amusement park, the aquarium, the Old Town Trolley, the shops and restaurants. There was parking closer in to all these points of interest and refreshment, but Norman didn't want to get closer in. He might feel it necessary to leave this area at some speed, and he didn't want to find himself mired in traffic if that turned out to be the case. The front half of the Press Street lot was nearly deserted at 9:45 on Saturday morning, not good for a man who wanted to keep a low profile, but there were plenty of vehicles in the day and week rate section, most the property of ferry customers who were off somewhere up north on day trips or weekend fishing expeditions. Norman eased the Ford Tempo into a space between a Winnebago with Utah plates and a gigantic Road King RV from Massachusetts. The Tempo was all but invisible between these big guys, and that suited Norman fine. He got out, then took his new leather jacket off the seat and put it on. From one of its pockets, he took a pair of sunglasses, not the same ones he'd worn the other day, and slipped these on as well. Then he walked to the rear of the car, took a look around to make sure he was unobserved, and opened the trunk. He took out the wheelchair and unfolded it. He had pasted the bumper stickers he'd bought in the gift shop of the Women's Cultural Center all over it. They might have lots of smart people giving lectures and attending symposia upstairs in the meeting rooms in the auditorium, but downstairs in the gift shop they sold exactly the sort of shrill, nonsensical shit Norman had been hoping for. He had no use for keychains with a female sign on them or the poster of a woman being crucified, "Jesusina died for your sins," on Golgotha, but the bumper stickers were perfect. "A woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle," said one. Another, obviously written by someone who'd never seen a bimbo with her eyebrows and half her hair singed off by a malfunctioning crack pipe, read, "Women are not funny." There were stickers that said, "I'm pro-choice and I vote. Sex is political," and "RESPECT, find out what it means to me." Norman wondered if any of these braless wonders knew that song had been written by a man. He bought them all, though. His favorite was the one he had carefully pasted in the center of the wheelchair's imitation leather backrest, next to the little customized holster for his Walkman. "I am a man who respects women," it said. And that's true enough, he thought, taking another quick check of the parking lot to make sure there was no one observing the cripple as he climbed spryly into his wheelchair. "As long as they behave themselves, I respect them fine." He saw no one at all, let alone anyone watching him specifically. He pivoted the wheelchair and looked at his reflection in the side of the freshly washed Tempo. Well, he asked himself, what do you think? Will it work? He thought it would. Since disguise was out of the question, he had tried to go beyond disguise, to create a real person, the way a good actor can create a real person on stage. He'd even come up with a name for this new guy, Hump Peterson. Hump was an army vet who'd come back home and ridden with an outlaw biker gang for 10 years or so, one of the ones where the women have only 2 or 3 very limited uses. Then the accident had happened. Too many beers, wet pavement, a bridge abutment. He'd been paralyzed from the waist down, but had been nursed back to health by a saintly young woman named Marilyn, Norman said, thinking of Marilyn Chambers, who for years had been his favorite porn star. His second favorite was Amber Lynn, but Marilyn Lynn sounded fake as hell. The next name to occur to him was McCoo, but that was no good either. Marilyn McCoo was the bitch who had sung with the Fifth Dimension back in the 70s, when life hadn't been as weird as it was these days. There was a sign in a vacant lot across the street. Another quality Delaney construction project will go up in this space next year, it said, and Marilyn Delaney was as good a name as any. He would probably not be asked to tell his life story by any of the women from Daughters and Sisters, but to paraphrase the sentiment on the shirt the clerk in the base camp had been wearing, it was better to have a story and not need one than to need one and not have one. And they would believe in Hump Peterson. They would have seen more than a few guys just like him, guys who'd had some sort of life-changing experience and were trying to atone for their past behavior. And the Humps of the world, of course, atoned the way they had done everything else in their lives, by going right to the firewall. Hump Peterson was trying to turn himself into a kind of honorary woman, that was all. Norman had seen similar scagbags turn themselves into passionate anti-drug advocates, Jesus freaks, and parotistas. At the bottom, they were really just the same one-note assholes they'd always been, singing the same old tune in a different key. That wasn't the important thing, though. The important thing was that they were always around, hanging on the fringes of whatever scene it was they wanted to be in. They were like tumbleweeds in the desert or icicles in Alaska, so yes, he thought Hump would be accepted as Hump, even if they were on the lookout for Inspector Daniels. Even the most cynical of them would be apt to dismiss him as no more than a horny crip using the old sensitive caring man routine to get himself laid on a Saturday night. With just a smidge of luck, Hump Peterson would be both as visible and as little noticed as the guy on stilts who plays Uncle Sam in the 4th of July parade. Beyond this, his plan was simplicity itself. He would find the main concentration of women from the group home, and he would watch them as Hump from the sidelines, their games and conversational groups, their picnic. When someone brought him a hamburger or a corn dog or a slice of pie, as some helpful cunt undoubtedly would, you couldn't propagandize their deep need to bring food to the menfolks out of them. That was instinct, by God. He'd take it with thanks, and he'd eat every bite. He would speak when spoken to, and if he should chance to win a stuffed animal playing ring toss or pitch till you win, he'd give it to some little kid, always being careful not to pat the rug muffin on the head. Even that could get you busted for molestation these days. But mostly, he'd just watch for his rambling rose. He could do that with no problem at all, once he had been accepted as a valid part of the scene. He was a champ at the art of surveillance. After he spotted her, he could take care of his business right here on the pier if he wanted to. Just wait until she had to use the potty, follow her, and snap her neck like a chicken bone. It would be over in seconds, and that, of course, was just the problem. He didn't want it to be over in seconds. He wanted to be able to take his time, have a nice, leisurely chat with her, get a complete rundown on her activities since she'd walked out on him with his ATM card in her pocket. The full report, so to speak, from chowder to cashews. He could ask her how it had felt to punch in his PIN number, for instance, and find out if she'd gotten off when she'd bent down to scoop the cash out of the slot, the cash he'd worked for, the cash he'd earned by staying up until all hours and busting scumholes who'd do anything to anybody if there weren't guys like him around to stop them. He wanted to ask her how she'd ever thought she could get away with it, how she thought she could get away from him. And after she told him everything he wanted to hear, he would talk to her. Except maybe talk wasn't exactly the right word for what he had in mind. Step one was to spot her. Step two was to keep an eye on her from a discreet distance. Step three was to follow her when she'd finally had enough and left the party, probably after the concert, but maybe earlier if he was lucky. He could ditch the wheelchair once he was clear of the amusement park. There would be fingerprints on it. A pair of studded biker gauntlets would have taken care of that problem and also added to the Hump Peterson image. But he'd only had so much time, not to mention one of his horrible headaches, his specials. But that was all right. He had an idea that fingerprints were going to be the least of his problems from here on out. He wanted her at her place, and Norman thought he was probably going to get what he wanted. When she got on the bus, and it would be the bus, she had no car and wouldn't want to waste money on a cab, he would get on right behind her. if she happened to spot him at some point along the line between Edinger's Pier and the crib where she was turning her tricks, he'd kill her on the spot and devil take the consequences. If things went well, though, he'd follow her right in through her door, and on the other side of that door, she was going to suffer as no woman on the face of the earth had ever suffered before. Norman wheeled his way to the booth marked All Day Passes, saw that adult admission was $12, handed the money to the guy in the booth, and started into the park. The way was clear, it was early, and Edinger's wasn't really bustling yet. Of course, that had its downside, too. He'd have to be very careful not to attract the wrong sort of attention. But he could do that. Buddy! Hey, buddy! Come back here! Norman stopped at once, his hands frozen on the wheels of his chair, blank eyes staring at the haunted ship and the giant robot in old-time ship's captain's clothes that stood out front. Ahoy for terror, matey! The robot ship's captain called over and over again in his mechanical drone of a voice. No, he didn't want to attract the wrong sort of attention, and here he was, doing precisely that. Hey, Baldy! You in the wheelchair! People turning to look at him. One was a fat black bitch in a red jumper who looked about half as bright as the base camp clerk with the hair lip. She also looked vaguely familiar, but Norman dismissed that as plain paranoia. He didn't know anyone in the city. She turned and walked on, clutching a purse the size of a briefcase, but plenty of other people were still looking. Norman's crotch suddenly felt humid with sweat. Hey, man, come back here. You gave me too much. For a moment, the sense of this didn't come through to him. It was like something spoken in a foreign language. Then he understood, and an enormous sense of relief, mingled with feelings of disgust at his own stupidity, washed over him. Of course he had given the guy in the booth too much. He had forgotten he was not an adult male, but a handicapped person. He pivoted and wheeled back to the booth. The guy leaning out of it was fat, and he looked as disgusted with Norman as Norman felt with himself. He was holding out a $5 bill. $7 handicap, can't you read? He asked Norman, first pointing at the sign on the booth with the bill and then shoving it into Norman's face. Norman entertained a brief vision of jamming the five spot into the fat fuck's left eye, then took it and stuffed it into one of his jacket's many pockets. Sorry, he said humbly. Yeah, yeah, the man in the booth said and turned away. Norman began wheeling himself into the park again, his heart pounding. He had carefully constructed a character, made simple but adequate plans to accomplish his aims, and then, at the outset, had done something not just stupid, but incredibly stupid. What was happening to him? He didn't know, but from this point on, he was going to have to work around it. I can do that, he muttered to himself. Goddamn right I can. Ahoy for terror, matey, the robot sailor droned down at him as Norman rolled past. In one hand, he waved a corncob pipe the size of a toilet bowl. Ahoy for terror, matey! Ahoy for terror, matey! Whatever you say, Captain, Norman muttered under his breath and kept rolling. He came to a three-way intersection with arrows pointing to the pier, the midway, and the picnic area. Beside the one pointing to the picnic area was a small sign which read, Guests and friends of daughters and sisters, eat at noon, eat at six, concert at eight. Enjoy. Rejoice. You bet, Norman thought, and began to roll his bestickered wheelchair down one of the concrete flower-bordered paths which led into the picnic area. It was actually a park, and a good one. There was playground equipment for children who had tired of the rides or found them too stressful. There were jolly topiary animals like the ones at Disney World, horseshoe pits, a softball diamond, and lots of picnic tables. An open-sided canvas tent had been set up, and Norman could see men in cook's whites inside, preparing to barbecue. Beyond the tent was a row of booths, which had clearly been put up just for today's events. At one, you could buy chances on a couple of handmade quilts. At another, you could buy T-shirts, many bearing the same sentiments which decorated Hump's wheelchair. At another, you could get any sort of pamphlet you wanted, as long as you wanted to find out how to leave your husband and find joy with your lesbian soul sisters. If I had a gun, he thought, something heavy and fast like a Mac-10, I could make the world a much better place in just 20 seconds. Much better. Most of the people here were women, but there were enough men that Norman did not feel particularly conspicuous. He rolled past the booths, being pleasant, nodding when nodded to, smiling when smiled at. He bought a chance on the snowflake quilt, putting his name down as Richard Peterson. It might not be such a good idea to call himself Hump, not here. He picked up a pamphlet called Women Have Estate Rights Too, and told the lesbo queen minding the booth he was going to send it to his sister Jeannie in Topeka. The lesbo queen smiled and told him to have a nice day. Norman smiled and said, "Right back at ya." He looked at everything in general, and for one person in particular, Rose. He didn't see her yet, but that was okay, the day was young. He felt almost positive she'd be here for the sit-down meal at noon, and once he'd gotten a confirmed sighting of her, all would be well, and all manner of things would be well. Okay, he had screwed up a little at the all-day booth, but so what? That was behind him now, and he wouldn't screw up again. Absolutely not. "Cool wheelchair, my friend," a young woman in leopard-skin shorts said cheerfully. She was leading a little boy by the hand. The little boy had a cherry snow cone in his free hand and appeared to be trying to coat his entire face with it. To Norman, he looked like a world-class booger. Cool sentiments, too. She held out a hand for Norman to slap, and Norman wondered, just for a moment, how fast that stupid little eye-break-for-cripple smirk would disappear from her face if he bit off a couple of her fingers instead of giving her the low five she was expecting. It was her left hand she was holding out, and Norman wasn't surprised to see there was no wedding ring on it, although the rugrat with the cherry shit all over his face looked just like her. "You slut," he thought. "I look at you, and I see everything that's wrong with this fucked-up world. What did you do, get one of your dyke friends to knock you up with a turkey baster?" He smiled and slapped her outstretched hand lightly. "You the best girl," he said. "Do you have a friend here?" the woman asked. "Well, you," he said promptly. She laughed, pleased. "Thanks, but you know what I mean." "No, just digging the scene," he said. "If I'm in the way or if it's a private gig, I can always head out." "No, no," she said, looking horrified at the idea, as Norman had known she would. "Stay, hang out, enjoy. Could I bring you something to eat? It would be my pleasure. Cotton candy, a hot dog maybe?" "No thanks," Norman said. "I was in a motorcycle accident a while back. That's how I lucked into the wonderful wheelchair." The bitch was nodding sympathetically. He could have her bawling in about 3 minutes if he felt like it. "I don't seem to have much appetite since then." He grinned tremulously at her. "But I enjoy life, by God." She laughed. "Good for you. Have a great day." He nodded. "Goes back double. You have a good day too, son." "Sure," the kid said noncommittally, and looked at Norman with hostile eyes from above his cherry-lathered cheeks. Norman had a moment of real panic, a sense that the boy was looking into him and seeing the Norman who was hiding behind Hump Peterson's stud horse clean head and many-zippered jacket. He told himself it was simple garden-variety paranoia he was feeling, no more and no less. He was, after all, an imposter in the court of his enemies, and it was perfectly normal to feel paranoid under such circumstances. But he went on his way quickly, just the same. He thought he would start to feel better again once he was away from the kid with the hostile eyes, but he didn't. His brief burst of optimism had been replaced by an antsy feeling. The noon meal was close now. People would be sitting down in 15 minutes or so, and there was still no sign of her. Some of the women were off doing the rides, and it was possible that Rose was among them, but he didn't think it was very likely. Rose wasn't a crack-the-whip kind of gal. No, you're right. She never was. But maybe she's changed, a voice inside whispered. It started to say something else, but Norman muzzled it savagely before it could get a single word out. He didn't want to hear that crap, even though he knew that something in Rose must have changed, or she'd still be at home, ironing his shirts every Wednesday, and none of this would be happening. The idea of Rose's changing enough to walk out of the house with his goddamn ATM card took hold again in his mind, took hold in a gnawing, beavery way he could hardly stand. Thinking about it made him feel panicky, as if there were a weight on his chest. "Stay in control," he told himself. "That's what you've got to do. Think of it as being on stakeout, as a job you've done 1,000 times before. If you can think of it just that way, everything will be fine. Tell you what you do, Normie. Forget it's Rose you're looking for. Forget it's Rose until you actually see her." He tried. It helped that things were going pretty much as he had expected. Hump Peterson had been accepted as a valid part of the scene. Two dykes wearing T-shirts cut off to display their overbuilt arms included him briefly in their frisbee game, and an older woman with white hair on top and really ugly varicose veins down below brought him a yogurt pop because, she said, he looked really hot and uncomfortable stuck in that chair. Hump thanked her gratefully and said, yes, he was a little hot. But you're not, sweetie, he thought as the woman with the graying hair started away. No wonder you're with these lesbo queens. You couldn't get a man if your life depended on it. The yogurt pop was good, though, cool, and he ate it down greedily. The trick was never to stay in one place for too long. He moved from the picnic area to the horseshoe pit, where two inept men were playing doubles against two equally inept women. To Norman, it looked as if the game might go on until the sun went down. He rolled past the cook tent, where the first hamburgers were coming off the grill, and potato salad was being dished into serving bowls. Finally, he headed for the midway in the rides, wheeling along with his head down, sneaking little peeks at the women who were now heading for the picnic tables, some pushing strollers, some carrying trumpery prizes under their arms. Rose was not among them. She did not seem to be anywhere.
Norman was too busy looking for Rose to see that the black woman who had noticed him earlier was noticing him again. This was an extremely large woman, one who actually did bear a slight resemblance to William Refrigerator Perry. Gert was in the playground pushing a little boy on a swing. Now she stopped and shook her head as if to clear it. She was still looking at the cripple in the motorcycle jacket, although now she could only see him from behind. There was a bumper sticker on the back support of his wheelchair. I am a man who respects women, it said. You're also a man who looks familiar, Gert thought. Or is it just that you look like some movie actor? Come on, Gert, Melanie Huggins' little boy commanded. Push! I want to go high! I want to loop the loop! Gert pushed higher, although little Stanley wasn't going to get anywhere near looping the loop. Not in this litigious age, thank you very much. Still, his laughter was a kick. It made her grin herself. She pushed him a little higher, dismissing the man in the wheelchair from her mind, from the front of her mind. I want to loop the loop, Gert, please. Come on, please. Well, Gert thought, maybe once wouldn't hurt. Hold on tight, hero, she said. Here we go.
Norman kept rolling, even after he knew he'd gone by the last incoming picnickers. He felt it wise to make himself scarce while the women from Daughters and Sisters and their friends were eating. Also, his sense of panic had continued to grow, and he was afraid someone might notice something wrong with him if he stuck around. Rose should be here, and he should have seen her by now, but he hadn't. He didn't think she was here, and that made no sense. She was a mouse, for Christ's sake, a mouse. And if she wasn't here with her fellow mouse-cunts, where was she? Where did she have to go, if not here? He wheeled beneath an arch reading, Welcome to the Midway, and traveled along the broad paved way, not paying much attention to where he was going. The best thing about riding in a wheelchair, he was discovering, was people watched out for you. The park was filling up, and he supposed that was good, but nothing else was good. His head was throbbing again, and the hurrying crowds made him feel strange, like an alien inside his own skin. Why were so many of them laughing, for instance? What in God's name did they have to laugh about? Didn't they understand what the world was like? Didn't they see that everything, everything was on the verge of going down the tubes? He realized with dismay that they all looked like lover girls and fag boys to him now, all of them, as if the world had degenerated into a cesspool of one-sex lovers, women who were thieves, men who were liars, none of them with any respect for the glue that held society together. His headache was getting worse, and the little bright zigzags had started to show around the edges of things again. The noises of this place had grown maddeningly loud, as if some cruel gnome inside his head had taken over the controls and was gradually turning the volume all the way up to max decibels. The rumble of the cars mounting the first slope of the roller coaster track sounded like an avalanche, and the screams of the riders as the cars fell into the first drop tore at his ears like shrapnel. The calliope farting out its steamy tunes, the electronic chatter from the video arcade, the bug-like whine of the go-karts speeding around the rally racer track. These sounds converged inside his confused and frightened mind like hungry monsters. Worst of all, pervading everything and digging into the meat of his brain like the blade of a dull auger, was the chant of the mechanical sailor in front of the haunted ship. He felt that if he hadn't listened to it bellow, "Ahoy for terror, matey!" just one more time, his mind would snap like a dry stick of kindling. Either that, or he would simply bolt out of this dumb fucking chair and go screaming through, "Stop, Normie."